Dr. Angela Dunn hadn't been in Utah all that long in the summer of 2014. By that time in her medical career, she had already shifted her focus from clinical work in obstetrics and gynecology to public health. And almost as soon as she began with the Utah Health Department, she had this opportunity to take a fellowship with the Centers for Disease Control in Sierra Leone. This was just months after an outbreak of Ebola virus disease in West Africa.
I was sent to Sierra Leone almost immediately and was assigned to this village that hadn't had any federal help yet. So I was the first representative there from the CDC and other NGOs who were partnering with us to try to get them started with their contact tracing, their infection control practices. So really kind of starting from nothing. And one of the elements that was part of that, it was actually doing the contact tracing. And, you know, you could only take the car so far, and then you'd have to stop at the bush and walk the rest of the way to another village to figure out, you know, who came into contact with somebody who had recently passed away from Ebola. And Ebola is spread by touch. It's very different than what we're experiencing with COVID-19 that's spread by airborne droplets. So you tended to keep yourself covered. And on this particular day, it seemed hotter than usual and we were walking through this thick brush. So, you know, I rolled up my pant legs and my sleeves because it was so hot. And we get to the village and, you know, most people in West Africa in these villages had never seen a white person before. And that exposure of my bare leg tempted this little innocent boy to reach out and touch my leg. The moment his hand made contact with my bare skin, it felt like shockwaves were just sent through my body. I hadn't been touched by another individual for at least a month. And we were taught to fear that touch. They didn't react. I was collected because you don't want to frighten the child or anyone else. But I remember feeling extremely panicked and running through scenarios in my head of how I could cleanse my leg but not make the boy feel bad, and but I didn't want to get Ebola, and kind of all these crazy thoughts just rushing through my head. And then, you know, as I laid down that night, I immediately just thought about that moment of, I've never felt fear from a human touch, and that made me so sad. For me, that's truly the most tragic part of COVID-19. We're telling people to stay away from elderly family members and loved ones. And our culture is so used to feeling that comfort of hugging and holding hands. And, you know, an infectious disease can make us fear the thing that usually comforts us in times of stress.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, who has become a constant presence in Utah since the coronavirus took hold. She's gotten a lot of attention for her clear-eyed analysis and leadership. Her role in the daily briefings has been notable for her poise, but she told us she's kind of amused by this public persona. She says she's not all that collected or calm in her personal life.
If you spoke with my husband, he would probably say that that's all fake. Because I'm definitely, my personality on a day-to-day basis is definitely fiery and opinionated and seeking justice and speaking up when I see injustice. So that is the way I'm wired. However, I recognize that what's needed right now in this moment is a sense of clarity about what we know and what we don't know, and then a sense of clear principles to guide people's actions to keep them safe in the best way we know how. And And I'm happy to play that role right now for Utah. I hope that it is helping people weather this storm, you know, with a little more confidence, hopefully, than otherwise.
I wanted to ask you about what life was like in your early days. You grew up in Texas mostly, moved a lot though for your family's work. And was that difficult? Did you keep to yourself, or were you really social as a kid?
No, I was very social. Yeah, we moved around a lot. So, I mean, my parents were 21 when they had me. My dad worked for an oil company, was climbing the corporate ladder, and that made us move a lot. So I was in a lot of different elementary schools. I don't have friends from kindergarten anymore. And that's okay. Some people think that's sad, but I actually cherish my childhood. I got to live in a bunch of different places, you know, and every town and city has their own culture. So I got to kind of be among people who were different than me constantly and learn how to adapt and make new friends. And for me, that's exciting. I love change, and I love learning other people's stories and why they live the way they do, and then moving on to the next place and figuring it out all over again. So I really cherish that piece of my childhood.
Were you looking for adventure, excitement?
Yeah, definitely change, I think, is more. Yeah. I'm not like an adventure seeker in the way that a lot of Utahns are. So yeah, there's a higher standard here. But I do love change. So every few years, I like to move. I like to change jobs. I like to figure out a new way to live. Of course, as I've gotten older, and I have two young children now, and a husband who is not a change seeker, things are definitely different. But I think the element of, you know, travel or learning new things or picking up new hobbies definitely keeps that sense of wonder alive in me. And that's really what I'm seeking, is just continuously learning new things, right? Not being stagnant or complacent.
When you were younger, when you dreamt about what it is you wanted for your life, what did you think of in those days? Was it always science and medicine?
No. I actually went to college and took a journalism class, thought I wanted to be a journalist. Tried to convince my dad that an art history major was the way to go. Took a photography course. I took West African dance. I was all over the board. I majored in international relations with a focus on political economy and development. And my fascination there was, again, learning about different cultures and how they all interact and how that impacts the daily lives of people. I really like that. And at my core, I'm a liberal arts major. I love reading and writing. So science was not my natural instinct, but I really was attracted to the idea of being able to help people and combine that curiosity about kind of why they live the way they do and how it impacts their health, and then what can I do to help improve that. So in my early days in childhood, I was just interested in traveling and helping people. That was it. I didn't really ever think about going into medicine until my senior year of college.
So you wondered what it was you could do. And I wonder how much your mother, a nurse, influenced that idea of wanting to help people.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that was the kind of that moral compass by which we live, was always figuring out how we could give back, recognizing that, you know, we were born with a silver spoon in our mouths. Yeah. And that comes with some responsibility to use that to give people a voice that wouldn't otherwise have one, to help people that are struggling. And that's how I grew up. And my mom definitely instilled that in us. We were always involved in community organizations, doing, and it, you know, it never had to be something formal. You know, it was always just looking out for neighbors, figuring out who was ill or had an ill family member, and stopping by and providing dinner. So from the little things to, you know, doing Christmas carols to her patients who were Medicaid patients with home health, you know, we always had something like that going on in our family.
October 2014, you go to Sierra Leone to work with the CDC, so wasn't it? That, right, yeah.
Yep, yeah. So I was employed by the CDC there, yeah. And they had set up their country office, or a country office, in Sierra Leone.
I wanted to ask you more about that. What was it like to have been there? And this sort of coincides with this outbreak of Ebola. So I'm wondering, just professionally, it must have been exciting. But I wonder, what was the personal dimension of what you were seeing? Give me a sense of what it was you were seeing when you were there.
Sure. I mean, yeah, to your point, it was certainly exciting. The moment that I knew I had the opportunity to go, I was emailing people and asking how quickly I could get on a flight. It is something I wanted to do. I had a 2-year-old at the time, and my husband said, "Why? Now tell me why you have to go. Like, why do you specifically have to be there?" But also,
wait. How serious was that conversation, though? Honestly, was he like, "Honey, you don't have to do this. We have a kid. You can't go do that."
Oh no, he would never say that.
Yeah. He knows you too well.
There has not been one conversation where he hasn't provided complete support for what I've wanted to do. So it was a question from him, like, why do you specifically have to go? And my answer to him was, if it's not me, then it's going to be someone else. And I'd rather it be me, because I know I can do a good job. And he understands that and supports that. So
what did you mean by that, that you knew you could do a good job? What were the gifts you figured you had that you could contribute?
You know, I just, that feeling of, you know, if you're faced with something with, if you, you know, a community is faced with a really hard decision or hard situation, I'd rather it be me helping them figure it out, because I don't want to just sit back and watch it happen. I want to be part of the solution, because I know that I will commit myself 110%, and that's what I can give, and that's what I can control. And sitting back and watching it happen is not an option. So you asked about kind of like, what was it like when we got there? You know, funny story. So I had only lived in Utah for about a month prior to going, and I didn't know anything about Utah before I came here. I hadn't even set foot in Utah, so really had no connections. But so you fly into Freetown, Sierra Leone, and you have to take a boat across a body of water in order to get to the main part of the city where the hotels are and stuff. And on the boat dock, there are Sierra Leoneans selling cell phone cards so that you can talk on the cell phone, so minutes for a cell phone. And one of them said to me, you know, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, the United States." He's like, yeah, but what state?" And I said, "Oh, Utah." And he goes, "Utah? Are you LDS?" And I was like, "No." He's like, "Oh, I am." And I just thought, wow, the first person I meet in Sierra Leone is Mormon. Like, that's crazy. So that was simultaneously my introduction to Sierra Leone and Utah at the same time. But so, you know, once I got, Freetown is just kind of a city. And the main shock was when I got to the village I was assigned to. You know, their health department was a cinder block, one room building with no AC, no internet. The power would come in and out. They did not have flush toilets. And it was also full of corruption. So the leader of the health department was taking all the money from international organizations that were trying to help for Ebola, and he would pocket it and then give it out as bribes, and do it openly. I mean, it was in front of me. He would give it out as bribes to ambulance drivers, to burial team members, to his friends. So seeing such poverty and pain with the openness of corruption was shocking. It was also shocking to go by the holding centers. So, you know, in with the Ebola response, they turned all their hospitals into what they called holding centers, where people who were sick but didn't have their Ebola results yet were basically waiting for their results. And a lot of them were sick, and there wasn't enough healthcare. So, you know, they had, you know, literally people laying on the ground behind barbed wire fences with nobody to care for them because people were either too scared. There were healthcare providers that were dying from Ebola. But then also, if anybody stepped up in that community to help Ebola victims, they were immediately ousted from their communities.
Wow.
So they themselves were stigmatized and couldn't go back and see their own families because they had decided to help. We even had terrible situations where children who survived, so their parents passed away. We had this one boy who was about 8 years old. Both his parents had passed away from Ebola. He had survived. And we went to his village to return him to his village. And we show up and they start throwing rocks at this 8-year-old boy who had just lost his parents. And now his community was shunning him because they were scared. So, you know, with any epidemic, the fear and the panic truly brings out the worst in us. We become irrational beings because we're scared and we don't know how to best protect ourselves. So when it comes to COVID, what you know, my goal is and the Department of Health's goal is to give very clear information to the public, again, about what we know, but even more importantly, what we don't know, because it is a new virus and there is a lot we don't know. And that's why it's scary. And that's okay. But we do know of some really good things that can keep you and your loved ones safe. So it is such an intersection between science and the art of science, which incorporates culture.
But what part of you, the wanting to speak up, the person who seeks justice, who does speak up from when the time is appropriate, what part of you came out then in Sierra Leone when you saw that?
Oh, gosh. So when a clear example is when all of the funding. So there, you know, with any emergency situation, whether it's a hurricane, an earthquake or Ebola or a pandemic, you know, you get tons of offers of money, private organizations, nonprofits, government organizations just want to throw money at it. So there was a lot of money coming into our emergency operations center in Freetown, so the capital of Sierra Leone. And I was responsible for figuring out what my village needed and advocating for it. And there was a time when we had no cell phones and no motorbikes to do contact tracing. And I had heard that they were keeping the majority of the money for Freetown, the center. And it was my job to go and advocate to leadership of the CDC to say, this is why Tongolili needs this much money, because without it, this town is going to be decimated because there are no roads. We need motorbikes. There are no cell phone towers. Those need to be built. And then we need cell phones. And having to advocate for my village on a daily basis, you know, going up against the needs of everyone else in Sierra Leone, was pretty tough. I mean, because you're faced with really life or death situations based on those funding decisions. You know, another clear example that I remember, it was the end of my 6-week deployment, and I had been training my replacement for about a week to take over. You know, whenever you leave, that Tongolili, where I was, became my home, and the people I worked with became my family. And so me leaving, I really wanted to trust the person I was leaving to take care of them. So I'd been training her for a week, felt really comfortable. Then I get an email the night before I was going to leave saying that Grace, who is going to replace me, has to come on the plane with me back to the U.S. as well, because she's not a U.S. citizen. And the administration, the presidential administration of the U.S. has decided that they don't want to risk non-U.S. citizens being in Sierra Leone because they're not going to extract them should they get infected with Ebola. So we were both forced to leave and leave without anybody left to take care of Tonkalili. And that led me to call everyone up my chain of command, strongly advocating for someone to go either keep me behind or for someone to take over to make sure that there's still contact tracing and protecting the community against the spread of Ebola. So it is that mix of kind of politics and health that there seems to be always opportunities for me to show my justice side.
Yeah. That's Dr. Angela Dunn. She's the state epidemiologist, also an adjunct professor in the Family and Preventative Medicine Department at the University of Utah School of Medicine. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and, of course, sneak peeks at what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches, too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with state epidemiologist Angela Dunn, who has emerged as a reassuring presence and the face of Utah's effort to manage the coronavirus pandemic. We wanted to ask her about the stories and experiences that have influenced her life. I wonder, Dr. Dunn, how did you comfort someone who was infected with a disease that could be fatal? Did you learn something about that part of all of this, is how to comfort someone, how to be with someone?
Yeah, absolutely. So my a big part of my job when I was there was training healthcare providers, ambulance drivers, nurses, physicians about how to keep them safe from Ebola. And we ended up having an outbreak in a hospital, which caused all of the labor and delivery staff to be quarantined because they were all exposed, and the patients. So women who had just had babies and all of the nurses were quarantined. So one way that I found was really powerful to comfort individuals in those situations was to learn about their lives, to ask questions about what their life was like before Ebola, and have those happy stories come out, those memories of when we could all be together and we could touch and hug and dance and sing and not be scared. They taught me their local dialect. I learned about their cultures and their food and how they would celebrate and how they would bury their loved ones, which they weren't able to do that the same way.
Yeah.
So it is kind of the same way we would mourn the loss of a loved one, but you're mourning the loss of a lifestyle. And that's how we were able to connect and find some happy moments.
What did that experience in Sierra Leone teach you about the way to lead out in the role that you're playing now in Utah during this outbreak, this pandemic?
You know, I think the first thing that it taught me was to understand that while science is important, it's also important to understand what's going on specifically within a community. What do they fear? How do they live? How do they interact with each other? And how does all of that impact the spread of the disease? So, you know, we might in public health read journal articles about what was happening in Wuhan and what we've learned from Italy. But none of that really matters unless you're able to apply it to the specific communities here in Utah. And that's the way I approach any outbreak, is really understanding what are the barriers that are preventing people from keeping themselves safe.
When did you realize first that this was going to affect the world and that was going to have a direct impact on not only the state, but that you were going to have to play a role in all of this?
Oh, I mean, we were tracking this from when it was first identified in Wuhan. And at that point, it was just animal to human spread.
Yeah. But did it worry you then?
No. So we were watching it.
Yeah.
It worried me when it was human to human spread.
Yeah.
With that first human to human spread is when we stood up our incident command center. We started doing what they call sentinel surveillance to identify, make sure we were ready to identify the first case in Utah. And we were putting plans in place for when it did come to Utah. We knew it would come.
So when you get everyone together, when you get your team together and you say, okay, guys, here's the plan. This is what we need to do. What's that conversation like? Like, what's the strategy? What's the like the bigger theme that you are trying to convey beyond the little details? Like, what are you saying to them that you need to be ready for, that you should be paying attention to? Like, what's the strategy like as you think about it?
Yeah, so the first thing we look at is kind of what are those symptoms that we're looking for? So we have surveillance systems in place that identify certain syndromic characterizations. So the first step is, you know, what are we looking for, guys? You know, and at the time we're looking for fever, cough, shortness of breath. Well, that doesn't really help us, right? We were in the middle of flu season. Like that's everybody at that point. So then the next step is, well, how would it even get to Utah? So we start brainstorming of, you know, are there ways to identify that first case by risk? And of course, at that point, it was travel from China. So we started identifying all the groups in Utah that had connections to China that would be likely traveling between China and Utah, and started doing immediate outreach to all those groups to let them know about the signs and symptoms and what to do if they thought they were sick or one of their loved ones was sick. At that time, we were prepping for Sundance Film Festival. The Chinese Lunar New Year was upon us. We had a lot of businesses that were doing hosting conferences and guests from China. So we were really identifying those kind of community organizations and events that were likely to have travelers coming back and forth.
So when you were talking with your team about the way you wanted to address the public, talk to the public and to public officials, what did you say? Guys, let's stick with the facts. Let's be calm. What was the conversation like there?
I mean, you know, we have a great team at the Department of Health, and this is definitely not the first, it's our first pandemic, but not our first big outbreak. So at the beginning of this, you know, we didn't know if it was going to be a pandemic.
Yeah.
We were treating it just like our bread and butter infectious disease outbreaks. You know, we had just stepped off the heels of EVALI, which was, you know, not an infectious disease, but another unknown disease plaguing Utahns. You know, we've dealt with hepatitis C, with hepatitis A, with measles, all within the last 12 months to 24 months. So for us, this is just what we do. And we always strive to provide that calm, fact-based message, focusing on the individuals that need it most. And then, of course, as the outbreak gets larger, focusing on the general public. And I would have to say, like, the other piece of this is we immediately bring in our healthcare system experts. So we have so many smart people in Utah that are part of the University of Utah, Intermountain, and other healthcare systems, you know, expert laboratorians, virologists, immunologists, and we immediately bring them into the conversation to help have that scientific expertise on our team as well.
I'm thinking about what I read about your father. He was pretty strict. And if I get this right, he insisted that you look people in the eye when you're talking to them. And I'm wondering if that influence had any effect on the way you talk to the public. Like, just let me just say it like it is. Let me be candid and come right out with it.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad would be so proud to hear that. he was very adamant that all of his children were well-spoken, clear, concise, to the point in all of our communications. So I definitely think that had an impact on how I am able to do public speaking now.
How do you think about the political part of this pandemic? You mentioned this a bit before, but like the different perspectives that tend to fall along partisan lines. You have someone, for example, in a team that you're working with. It's not the medical team, but it's the leadership, the government leadership, someone who disagrees or is skeptical of the science or the projections and feels like that, you know, we're overreacting. How do you deal with that? How do you think about that? How do you assert yourself and remain firm, but not sure. Dismiss them? Like, do you have a strategy for all of that?
Yeah, and I think it's the way I deal with all individuals I work with. Hmm. You got to put yourself in their shoes. We're all coming from a place of wanting to do good. We're all coming from a place of what we see as logical thinking. So I always try to get into their heads. What are the pressures they're feeling? What do they see as the biggest issue related to this pandemic? It might not be the same as mine. And you know what? It's probably better if it's not. I think we are doing a great job in Utah because we have so many different perspectives around the table providing input to the governor on policy, that will just make it a stronger and better policy. So that's what I do. You know, I try to put myself in their shoes, and most of the time I can do it. I mean, there have been very few instances in my career where I've said, oh, I just cannot understand why that person is making that decision. Hmm. You know, even if I don't agree with it, at least I can try to figure out why.
But there haven't been moments, and you don't have to share them, of just intense frustration where you just had to sort of walk away or go home and just privately tell your husband that this was driving you crazy?
Sure. Oh, of course. God, we've been... So I've been doing this since January,
yeah.
Have not had a weekend off,
yeah.
Right? I mean, we're all exhausted. There have, of course, been frustrating moments because, again, it goes back to this is a scary time. People are panicked. And then people in power are going to want to act quickly to try to relieve that panic. Mm. And sometimes the decisions aren't the decisions I would have made. Sometimes the decisions don't even include my opinion. And of course, that's frustrating to me, but that doesn't mean what they're doing is wrong. But there have certainly been moments where I have had to put the Zoom meeting on mute and turn off my camera and walk away for a little bit. So the benefit of social distancing is that I have maintained somehow the ability to keep my job through all this.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the science part, the epidemiological part. And I wonder if you see this as a test of this science, in the sense that these projections and the practice of epidemiology itself, I know a lot of people who understand it understand that the models are not going to be perfect, that there's a lot of fine-tuning that has to go along with all of this. But then when the projections go off, people start to wonder and are skeptical. How are you talking about that?
So, you know, it's interesting because throughout this pandemic, people are thirsty for data.
Yeah.
However, when the data doesn't show them what they want or what they expect, they're quick to dismiss it.
Yeah.
So I have learned that while data is important, building a trusting relationship with those who are creating policy is probably the best tactic in terms of being able to insert science and evidence into that policy. It is all about trust and relationships, regardless of what the data shows.
How do you react to the... you know, that question that says, look, the cure could be worse than the disease, which is, you know, it's been expressed by more than just President Trump, that, you know, the idea that by keeping the economy restrained, you risk other health consequences that go along with all of that. And how do you find the balance? How do you think about that? And how do you respond to that question? The idea that there are always going to be risks. We can't insulate people from risk. What do you say to that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I am lucky to have had conversations with former Governor Leavitt on this. And he has that famous quote of everything you do in advance of a pandemic seems alarmist and anything you do after seems inadequate. And right. And that was so important for me to hear at the beginning of this, because it allows me to go forward and provide recommendations, even in the face of people telling me that I'm crushing the economy. But I have to tell you, I have a background in economics. Public health is tangled with economics. There is no way to separate public health and economics. I am acutely aware that the longer this goes on, the more likely we are to drive people in poverty that can potentially set up bad health outcomes apart from COVID for their family for generations. That weighs on me heavily. So that's the kind of long-term consequences of both public health and economic impact. When we look at what we're dealing with right now, we cannot open the economy successfully unless we're able to provide confidence and assurances to the people of Utah that they can go out to stores, they can go out to restaurants or the movie theaters safely. It doesn't matter what color we're in. It doesn't matter how many cases we've had. People won't engage in the economy until they feel like it's okay to do.
Yeah.
And the way that people are going to feel comfortable doing that is if we make sure we're driving the illnesses down. So again, that health and economics are just so linked that we can't, it's not an either or, they're together. And when we talk about finding that balance, there's really not a balance because they're both going together.
Yeah.
If we have excess mortality and deaths and tragedies out of COVID-19, the economy is going to suffer. So we have to make sure that we're thinking about both at the same time. And we are. I truly believe we're striking that balance here in Utah. So I am optimistically confident, but also cautiously confident, because again, this is a pandemic and the virus could certainly rear its head again and have a spike, and we're prepared for that as well. So having that humility, I think, is really important as well moving forward.
Well, you mentioned your training in economics, and I'm trying to put that against the training you've had as a physician, because sure. the economist part can actually find an actual price to human life. Like you can work that out, but the medical part of you wouldn't even think of it. That's a weird place to be. That's a weird bunch of tension there.
It is. If I was, a traditional physician that treated patients one-on-one, most of those physicians are able to figure out what treatment is best for the patient and provide it in that moment. You know, we all are acutely aware of the strains on our healthcare system and how, you know, that's not true all of the time because the individual's ability to pay dictates their treatment. But on a population level, when you're in the world of public health, we are constantly faced with limited resources. We are always the first to get cut when there's budget cuts. It is hard for individuals and policymakers to find value in public health when there's not a pandemic, because what we do is prevention. And it's always hard to measure the null. So we're used to doing cost analysis like this and figuring out what is the most cost-effective way to allocate scarce resources. So while it is a tough position, it's not an unfamiliar one.
Yeah.
And I am fully aware of the impact of, you know, when we say shelter in place and shut everything down and people losing their jobs, that in and of itself is horrific. But if we open up way too early, we definitely risk prolonging that economic impact, because the cases will linger and the deaths will linger, and that consumer confidence might take longer to come back.
The state has lower numbers of hospitalizations and deaths than many other states. The coordinated effort so far has been, at least from as far as we can all tell, you know, mostly free of conflict and tension. Why has Utah done so well, relatively speaking?
We had a lot of things going for us at the beginning of this. Mostly we have the youngest state in the nation, and we know that COVID-19 impacts individuals over 65 years more than other age groups. So just that fact alone helps us. We also have a very low smoking rate. We're usually lowest or second to lowest in the nation on that. So our lungs are relatively healthy compared to other states, and that gives us a leg up with COVID-19. We also have incredible healthcare systems here that come to the table immediately at the beginning of these crises and help us figure out problems together. So that collaboration culture has benefited us so much in this pandemic response. Building up our testing capacity together, our contact tracing capacity together. It has never been about stepping on each other's toes or who's taking credit. And that has given us a powerful advantage in fighting COVID-19.
Okay, so I saw your latest update, 6,749 cases. It's an increase of 129 from the day before, 1.9% increase. No additional deaths. The governor mentioned he likes the trend. I mean, he's cautious, of course. How are you thinking about the trend? What are you seeing there? The idea that we're at a plateau, I don't know if you would call it that. Yeah. Some are.
Yeah, we're definitely at a plateau. Yeah. It is fantastic. We have reached a steady plateau for about 2 weeks, and that's what we want to see, even though our testing has remained stable. I am really looking for a decrease for me to start feeling comfortable. This plateau is fantastic, but that means there's still all these little embers out there. And we have to be very cautious because at any moment, one of those embers could turn into a forest fire again. So from a public health perspective, we are very cautious in our interpretation of that data because we know what could happen if we become too relaxed at this point in the outbreak. But having seen how well we've done so quickly, again, that gives me great joy and pride to be part of the Utah Department of Health and our local health departments. I mean, we really have quality people here in Utah working so hard on this, but we're all looking for that downward trend that we just haven't seen yet.
So it's a trend you're looking for? I mean, like, what in particular right now are you looking for that may tell you whether, like this is the one thing I want to see that's going to tell me the state is going to be able to head towards some kind of normalcy again, further ease?
Oh, exactly. So there's two things that I'm looking for. So, okay, in general, these aren't the two things, but overall, we're always looking at our hospital capacity.
Yeah.
We do not want to overwhelm our hospitals. So we're looking at ICU beds, we're looking at general hospital beds. The other thing we're always looking at is testing capacity. We want to make sure that we maintain testing capacity. You don't want to see a decrease in cases because we stop testing people. We want to see the same number of tests, but a lower number of positives. So that leads into the two things I look for. The first is a decrease in percent positive. So a decrease in the percent positive of all those tested. We've held steady at about 4.2%. I want to see that below 3%. We've been very consistent with the 4 to 5% positive for the past several weeks. And that just means that it's spreading consistently. We need to start seeing a decrease in order to have confidence that we're actually controlling this better. The second piece I'm looking for is actually a drop in cases. So we mentioned the plateau. We've had a plateau for a couple weeks. Once I see a decrease in cases every day for 14 days, I will feel like we're getting to being out of the woods. But right now, we're just not there.
So beyond the public health dimensions, I wanted to ask you about the social dimensions of all of this. And it's a question that I find myself thinking about a lot. How do you hope this experience will change us as a society? And I don't mean speaking as the state epidemiologist. I mean speaking as a mom, a wife, a member of the community, you know, a fan of the liberal arts.
So the first thing I hope happens is I hope we recognize that the truly vulnerable around us are those who have jobs that don't have good sick leave, that they can't telework, that they're hourly workers and can't stay home when they're sick. What's causing this disease to spread in communities more than others is exactly that fact, that people have to choose between going to work with a minor cough or staying home and not being able to put food on the table. And the fact that we have those pockets of communities in our state is heart-wrenching to me. And we need policies that provide the necessary support to these communities and to businesses and employers to provide adequate sick leave, so that when we have these infectious disease outbreaks and public health is saying, hey, you have to stay home for 2 weeks, they can actually do that. We know that that's not happening in some communities because they can't. And that's why they are still considered hotspots. So I am hopeful that this will change our perspective on these sorts of policies moving forward and will give us kind of that broader view of the true impact of these sorts of things.
So let me ask you finally, you've described yourself as a nomad. Your husband is definitely not that. He didn't like to move around like you did. So I wonder, your nomadic tendencies now, do you expect them to flare up again? At some point, will you respond to them and be off to somewhere else? Or are you settled in for at least the time being?
So we've made a compromise that we just get to travel more. I'm not allowed to move homes, but I am allowed to buy plane tickets or book camping sites a little more regularly. So that'll definitely scratch the itch of my nomadic lifestyle.
Dr. Angela Dunn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Dunn. She's the state epidemiologist, also an adjunct professor in the Family and Preventative Medicine Department at the University of Utah School of Medicine. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Stay safe out there, all right?
Okay, you too. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye.